Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the mayor of Midway, Celeste Johnson, with an update from last week's city council meeting. Park City Planner Rebecca Ward with a preview of tomorrow's Park City Planning Commission meeting. And then Peace House Marketing Director Sally Tauber and board member Julie Joyce with details about this year's virtual Bling Fling. Well, the two Utah teacher unions are reacting to Governor Gary Herbert's Sunday night emergency address. Leadership feels that the measures don't go far enough to protect teachers, staff, and students as the COVID-19 cases increase. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on that.
In Sunday night's address, Governor Gary Herbert issued a statewide mask mandate, ordered limits on private and public gatherings, and canceled all K-12 school extracurricular activities, except for sports teams that are in state playoffs. He said based on CDC guidelines, they will begin faculty testing at colleges, universities, and in K-12 school districts. Utah Education Association President Heidi Matthews says the actions don't go far enough and that membership wants the governor to require school districts experiencing high levels of COVID transmissions to move secondary schools immediately to virtual online learning. She says it is not sustainable and it is unsafe for teachers and the community.
The impact on student learning with these constantly changing modalities, and above all, the huge, impossible, unsustainable working conditions of our teachers who are having to go back and forth in between teaching in all different manners. We must treat our schools as if they are a part of our communities, which they are, not separate them out, not have a separate set of standards for our schools that differs from the rest of the state.
Matthews says they will continue to have conversations with Governor Herbert's office and education advisor Karen Peterson about testing mandates and the need to move toward remote learning in the secondary schools. Matthews says closing schools is a community issue which should consider the short-term and long-term vitality of the profession, as well as the health of the entire community.
Our concern at the Utah Education Association is the health and well-being of our teachers and our adults in the school, all of our educators, so that they can be the best possible that they can be for their students. So in caring for our teachers, we care for our students, their families, and their communities, but we really need to be much more deliberate in taking care of our teachers and adults in our schools.
Utah's American Federation of Teachers President Brad Acey says his email, texts, and phone calls exploded with members concerned the governor's new orders did not include closures for schools. He says it is impossible to socially distance in a school. He says some parents send their kids to school even if they've been exposed to COVID-19.
We know that the infection rate is highest between ages 25 and 15. That is the group that are the super spreaders, and they're in our schools. It's impossible to police what the governor's mandating. Students will not keep their masks on when they're away from the classroom. When they're together in the hallways, they take their masks off. When they're at lunch, they sit right next to each other. Social interacting at school, hugging each other, greeting each other, shaking hands, high fives, you know, everything that kids have always done, and it's happening in our schools. So you cannot tell me that infections are not happening at school.
AC says he supports the governor's mask mandate and restrictions on large gatherings and wants those same guidelines to apply to schools.
I'm angry that the state is not acknowledging this, is that they will not close the schools for a time, go to online learning, and let's see if we can get these numbers down. Governor asks us to be socially responsible, and individually, we need to be responsible. We're trying. You cannot social distance in a school. They've already acknowledged that, and it's impossible. And you cannot police these mandates that are coming down.
Both Matthews and AC want secondary students to begin virtual classes immediately, with the likely need to continue through the Christmas holiday vacation. They say the pandemic case increases are dangerous, adding that the pressure on teachers is unsustainable. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
The Eastside Planning Commission is headed for a work session in January following the debate at their November 5th meeting about placing a trailer on a small lot in Samick East. Summit County Development Director Pat Putt says they're trying to deal with some planning issues that go beyond just Samick. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more about that.
Putt told KPCW that in Samick and other locales such as Uinta Lands near the Mirror Lake Highway, There is a question about whether areas designed for recreational cabins or single-family homes should also allow trailers or RVs. As we've reported, the recent debate concerned a requested low-impact permit from Cody and Wendy Sheffield to place a trailer on their parcel. Such a permit can be approved just by the development director, but Putt thought it was appropriate to take it to the East County Commission.
We had a discussion with the Planning Commission several months ago on that, and the room was pretty full. I don't think it's appropriate for one person to necessarily make a decision in a vacuum, and that person being me. Thought it was appropriate for everybody to have an opportunity just to speak to the matter. And
he said it's a complex issue and one where the East County Planning Code needs to respond.
It's, you know, neighborhood land use and historical use, you know, concerns over septic systems and water quality and so many layers to this. I think the fundamental problem that we have here has to begin with the way our code addresses this sort of activity, which it doesn't do very well at all. We have a basic definition of an open space recreation use, non-motorized, that speaks to campgrounds. We have a separate definition of a campground. Those two definitions don't thread together very well. We have a definition of a mobile home that's not skirted that could be allowed with a conditional use permit for 180 days. None of them really address this.
Putt said the county staff has drafted some amendments to Eastside Code to better define the uses.
Commercial campgrounds versus private or family campgrounds, what a recreational vehicle is in terms of being different than a mobile home. And I think what the Planning Commission has asked us to do is to pull those back off the shelf and bring those back to them in January so that we can consider making some of these amendments permanent, and that may give us better direction and some better performance standards to deal with some of these issues in the future.
As he observed, one side in the debate at SAMAC says they bought their property for seasonal recreational use and have done that for decades. The other side maintains that their covenants or restrictions call for home development.
I think we just have to step back, take a very deep breath, and work on better predictability in the code. Is there going to be a solution out there that everybody's satisfied? Maybe, but I think we can do a much better job of working together to define what these uses are, how long some of these uses, as in like bringing a trailer onto your property, you know, for the summer, and get those things into the code.
County Development Director Pat Putt. Also coming up, Putt said that on November 19th, the Eastside Commission will get an update on efforts to plan the Cedar Crest Village Overlay Zone in the Hoytsville area. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.
On the phone with an update from Midway City, I have Mayor Celeste Johnson. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with some of the items you discussed at last week's City Council meeting. There was a presentation from the CAPS group for the Wasatch Center for Advanced Professional Studies. One of the groups apparently has put together a town square master plan, a souvenir shop, and a community center exterior renovation. Is this for real? Or is this just for fun?
It is for real, but those were actually three different groups that you just named off. And it's an amazing high school program for these kids, and I'm excited that Midway's a part of it. It gives them an opportunity to have real life experience, and each group was specifically tasked with something we've been needing in Midway. The souvenir shop is working terrifically well under the guidance of Andy Jenkins, who's a local business owner here in Midway. We will be opening that souvenir shop up in the next month or two. They're pretty much exclusively getting it up and going, the build out of the space, ordering the products, et cetera, designing the logo for the sign, everything. It's been wonderful to watch them work. The second group are aspirational architect students, and they are looking at our community center, which has been for many, many years an LDS church. There was a land swap some years back, and the church became the property of the city.
to use as a community center. It's also where our city council chambers are. And they are, you know, it's just time to make it look like part of Town Square rather than an old church, right? So that's what they've been working on. They're working under Rob Bowis as a mentor who is an architect and is guiding them closely. Obviously, they don't have the skill set to really have the final thing, but the ideas, the concepts, they've done research on Swiss architecture. That's been a really fun project. And then Town Square, we wanted to get the input of this particular age group. We wanted to know what would bring you to a town square. And they've got some exciting ideas, and we'll be working closely with a firm that specializes in architectural designs in rural communities. So we're very excited about what they've been doing.
Awesome. Let's see, there was also a discussion about the Utah Climate and Clean Air Compact. Has the council agreed to sign on to this?
Yes. Yes, we have. We wanted to be a part of the communities around the state who are saying we clearly need to do more than what we're doing. And we're really happy about that.
So as a participant, what does it mean for Midway?
You know, I think what it really means, this is one of those, hey, we're going to support some changes and we really didn't have to obligate ourselves to anything in particular. But what it means for me is that I want to get our clean air group back up and running. The county had gotten a group of folks together to get started, and then COVID hit, and of course it kind of went to a back burner. I want to get that back up and running. And for me, what it means is that there are things we can be doing in this county that's rapidly growing on a building level to make a home more efficient. And those things contribute to better air. And those are some things that I personally am very excited into getting going.
Sure. Now, has Midway kind of taken some of the efforts that Park City has, and that in terms of setting any kind of net zero goals for the municipality, put into effect any anti-idling ordinances, anything like that?
Exactly the things we need to be working on. And I fully intend to kind of copy some of the work that Park City has already done. We adopted a clean air that resolution, 6 months ago, Clean Air Utah, I believe it's called, and are getting no idling signs up as far as ordinances and things like that. It'll probably be done through resolution. We're looking really just to raise awareness, to get folks to become a part of this without having to necessarily legislate it. Midway is already very conscious and very much aware of these things. Another thing that I think is critically important for us, our small recycling center that we've had here in the county hasn't been open for some time. And we need a curbside recycling program that's countywide. So there's things like that that I believe we need to be doing.
Okay. Let's see. Last week, the council also reviewed the CARES Act funds. How much money does Midway have here?
We had almost $450,000. Of that, a substantial portion went to our EMS. They desperately needed a transport van, and they needed that van to be outfitted with, the emergency equipment. Both things are not inexpensive. So we have given about $200,000 of that money to the EMS for that van and transport equipment, which will benefit our whole county. And we realize that that's not Midway specific, but Midway will absolutely benefit. And it was something that we could do that would help our whole community. The remainder of the money is being used for our businesses. About $50,000 has gone to our two big resorts, Vermont and the Homestead. And we had a Zoom meeting last Thursday with about 15 of our business owners here on Main Street explaining how simple it is for them to qualify for the remainder of this money. We want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to apply to reimburse themselves for some of the losses they've incurred this year. And we've had, so that meeting was Thursday, and sitting on my desk right now are probably 8 applications to get that money. So we have until the end of the month to show how the money is going to be spent, and we have until the end of December to actually spend it. So we're very encouraged that these small businesses will benefit from this as well. It is the nice thing, this happens so seldom with federal money, but it's been given to the state. The state has then given it to the municipalities and has totally left it up to the municipalities to just, you know, to hand that out. There are criteria, and we know what criteria have to be met, but it's not complicated criteria. So we are able to dictate how that money is going to be used.
All right. The Mountain Spa property also before the City Council for a zone map amendment. This is also the property that was to receive the first funds from the open space bond. So what did the council decide to do here?
Again, a positive, unanimous decision. This is a creative open space project because it does require that some large lots be created. A single home can be built on one of the lots. The plat will be restricted. There can be no further development. One of these lots is like 15 acres. One is 12. We've got a couple of 5-acre lots, and the homes are situated so they're not really visible. It's a way to protect a very critical entry corridor into Midway going west as well as going south. It's on a major roundabout here in Midway. The exciting thing is that the very interior part of this parcel will be a fairly small scale resort, which benefits Midway commercially, but the view corridors are being protected. And because it's such a unique project, you know, it's not your typical wide open 100 acres or something. There's actually, you know, going to have to be some property developed. And we really anticipated that we would have to do a lot of explaining on this project. We would have to help citizens understand how this money was going to be used. And at City Council meeting, we had nothing but positive feedback. The community is thrilled that these view corridors are going to be protected in perpetuity.
Okay, so how much money from that open space bond is going to be used for this?
They're requesting $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. Depending on what the parcels are able to sell for, the five residential lots, we may not have to give quite that much, but we have committed up to $1.5 million.
All right. And certainly over the years, we've seen a number of different development proposals for this property. Will it ever be used as it used to be? And I'm talking about back in the 80s when it was actually a public pool that people could go and enjoy the hot water.
We are absolutely hoping for that. The developer has indicated he has every desire to have a section of this be available for public use. So we're excited about that as well. There is a section of land on this property that actually would be contiguous to the resort, and that's the place where we could potentially have a public pool, something that maybe, whether or not it would be available to the public all the time or certain days of the week or how that's going to work. We haven't worked out those details, but we are working with a developer that's very willing and is happy to work with us and come up with a plan where the community can come back and use this property. It's such a historically significant parcel here in our town, and the sign, you know, the jokes abound. The sign spa is spelled with two A's because evidently the original developers of this, clear back so many years ago, wanted people to say spa, you know. So that sign is going to even stay as part of this project. We're all very excited about it.
All right. Council will also schedule to spend about an hour discussing an ordinance that would allow the density reduction subdivision. So what would this do?
We passed an ordinance that allows for a rural preservation subdivision about two and a half, three years ago, which made it much easier for a developer to come into a larger parcel and do a very small scale development. The lots, you had to have 5 acres per lot, but it gave you the opportunity to not have to do some of the infrastructure that can be so expensive. And it's been so successful that we wanted to create something where this could be done if the property isn't so much. The rural preservation subdivision, I believe you have to have at least 5 or 10 acres for that one to succeed. The smaller version is very similar, but you don't have to have as much acreage. And it just requires kind of clustering the 1 or 2 or 3 homes, but you would get those same benefits where you don't have to do some of the expensive infrastructure requirements that make a development so expensive. And the reason a developer typically maxes the property out with homes. That's how they recoup that investment. So we're working on continuing options for folks who want to come up here, develop a parcel, but not develop to its maximum density.
And did the council approve it, or does it still need to come back for?
Yes. Yes.
It was approved.
It was. We had a very positive city council meeting last week. It was all kind of fun stuff for us.
Quickly, I wanted to ask you, any updates on the effort to put the power lines underground, or is that done?
We have been talking to both Heber Light and Power and Rocky Mountain Power, and we will have that on our agenda next Tuesday night, and at that point we'll be able to discuss it in the open, the negotiations and so forth. You know, as with all compromises, we believe we have found something that's mostly good, and not everyone will be ecstatic, but we believe everyone will be on board.
All right. Finally, the Resort City
Sale. How's that for a teaser, Leslie?
Yeah, right. Yeah. We'll tune in. Finally, just want to ask you about the Resort City sales tax collection. So this, because of taking on some of those campsites now, you are still considered a resort city and able to collect those taxes?
Yes. And that has been obviously very important to us. And because of our residential growth, we are still, you know, a resort city by the skin of our teeth. So that's one of the other reasons Mountain Spa is important to us. It will put us in more of a comfort zone to be able to continue to collect those resort taxes.
Okay. Celeste, anything else you wanted to mention?
Things are going well in Midway, and this is a difficult time, this 2020 and the mask wearing and all of that, but I do want to mention that I fully support the governor's mandate for everyone to wear masks, and I plug that at every opportunity. We've got to get this under control. Our numbers up here are not good.
Okay. Celeste Johnson is the mayor of Midway. Thanks for your time this morning. Appreciate it. The Park City Planning Commission meets tomorrow starting at 5:30. On the phone with a preview, I have Park City Planner Rebecca Ward. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first up in work session, the Planning Commission will continue its discussion of a report put together by Cascadia Partners. It was a study that the city paid for to look at the practices for getting public and private developers to build affordable housing and basically an unaffordable place to live. Some of the recommendations, including reducing off-street parking standards and maximizing building heights. These allowances, however, would only be for qualifying master plan affordable housing developments. Can you tell us what the minimum requirements are for a development to be a qualified master plan affordable housing development?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now, the way that it's written in the code, and it's been this way since 1984, is that this code is intended for projects that are 100% affordable. But one of the things that we're looking into, and this was proposed back in 2018, is to allow for a mix of affordable and market rate units in order to use this code and the density bonus. So that is one of the factors that we're looking into as we evaluate ways to incentivize private development and public-private partnerships to develop affordable housing.
Yeah, so are we talking about any certain number of units or a minimum acreage that would make it a master plan affordable housing development?
So it would be triggered by the number of units that were affordable. And at this point, I think that one of the triggers that's been proposed is 50% of the units would be affordable and 50% would be market rate. That is something that we're still looking into to make sure that that this would, in fact, incentivize developers to develop affordable housing. And also the number of affordable units is going to impact some of the the bonuses and also the parking. Right now you can see from the Cascadia Partners recommendation that they're recommending reduced parking specific to the affordable units, but that the market rate units would still provide parking as required under the code.
All right. So do we have any proposals or any developments that could fall under this new change?
You know, that's one of the things that that initiated the study of this code way back in 2017. There haven't been any developments under this code. And so that's one of the things that Cascadia has been really helpful in helping the city identify what some of the barriers are and why this code may not always work. So they have recommended things like reducing the open space requirements and the setbacks. And those code changes were implemented in January of this year. And so now the parking reduction and the building height increase, those are the last two phases of this proposed amendment, and we're hoping that we can come back by the end of the year or early next year with a code that would in fact incentivize the private development of these affordable units.
Okay, so when we're talking about parking being reduced for the affordable units, any idea what that, I mean, is there a percentage that you're looking at, or is it a number of spots that you look at? Is that...
So Cascadia recommended 5 different strategies to reduce parking, and the one that was most supported by the Planning Commission was to offer a credit for off-site parking. So if there was parking available for tenants or owners of the affordable units that was within 800 to 1,000 feet of the site, and there was some sort of long-term agreement in place for use of the off-site parking, that received support so that the impacts would be mitigated. You know, the housing team they do an annual compliance report from people who are in the affordable housing units, and we do know that of all of the units that have responded, only 2 are without vehicles. So we still need to find a place to park these vehicles or to mitigate the impacts of reduced parking. So some of the amendments that the commission looked into is reducing parking for the affordable units, but also to mitigate that and make sure that the units are close to transit, that there's maybe a car share program in place for tenants, and motorcycle and scooter parking or bike parking. So one thing that the commission did request that staff do is look into further researching how these reduced parking impacts can be mitigated.
Okay.
And another thing that they were wanting more information on, one of the strategies is to allow on-street parking that abuts the property or the development to count toward the parking requirement. And the commission voted 4-2 to support that, but requested that we work with the parking department to make sure that there's some sort of permit program or parking management plan in place so that there's not an impact to the neighboring community.
Let's see, what's being discussed in terms of maximum building height? Right now in residential zones, it's 33 feet. I mean, how tall would we allow?
So Cascadia is recommending up to 45 feet, so a 4-story building. And then they are recommending some mitigations like step downs so that the building height steps down to neighboring properties to the zone height that's allowed. They're also recommending some mitigations like facade articulation and maximum building length so that the impact of those really taller buildings kind of steps back from the pedestrian experience at the street level.
Yeah, how do we make that fair, though? I mean, certainly neighboring properties bought based on the 33-foot height limit, and now things kind of get pulled out from underneath them.
Absolutely, and that's one thing that the staff report identifies are the different zones. Like, staff is not necessarily recommending this for the historic districts or for residential districts, but maybe there are opportunities in commercial areas or near the resorts where these higher buildings would blend in with the nearby properties.
Okay. Any idea when the Planning Commission could make a recommendation to City Council?
So the work session scheduled for tonight, we should wrap up the building height and then staff will return with a proposed code. We're hoping either December 9th or in early 2021.
Okay. Also on the agenda, a public hearing on the proposed updates to the city's outdoor lighting regulations. Is the Planning Commission scheduled to make a recommendation on this tonight?
They are scheduled to make a recommendation tomorrow night. We still have our survey. It's open until 5 p.m. today, so we're encouraging people in the community to complete our survey and to provide public input. We've had a great response so far. We've had almost 300 responses, and it's helped us shape the code that we're bringing before the commission tomorrow night.
Okay. And can you talk to us about how this will affect just a regular property owner? I know that it has a lot to do with changing out commercial and like hotels and lighting and things like that. But what about just the condo and single family homeowners?
Yeah, from the survey results, it sounds like 73% of the survey respondents felt that their properties could come into compliance by 2024. The code amendments were proposing that they do apply to all new construction moving forward. The big question is to whether we should go back and require that all properties come into compliance by December of 2024. But from the input that we've heard and also from reaching out to other communities, for single family homes and smaller apartments, the upgrades tend to be pretty easy and not so expensive. It's some of the commercial properties and larger projects where this could require a pretty significant investment.
Okay. So any idea if there are going to be some funding to help those that might not be able to change it out, if in fact that's the course they go to have it replaced by 2024?
Yeah, I think that will be the big question. We're looking into potential grants if there are properties that could show economic hardship. And so we'll see what the commission and the council say on whether this should apply retroactively to existing properties.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add, Rebecca?
No, to participate in the public hearing tomorrow at 5:30, you can visit parkcity.org/public meetings.
Okay. And then the survey, again, is also online at parkcity.org?
The survey is available at engageparkcity.org.
Okay. All right. Rebecca Ward is the planner for Park City. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, the Peace House is hosting its annual fundraiser, the Bling Fling, but have had to figure out a way to do it virtually due to the increasing numbers of COVID-19. On the phone with details, I have Sally Tauber, Peace House's marketing director, and board member Julie Joyce. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So,
good morning, Leslie.
So, Sally, things are going to look a little bit different. No in-person boutique this year?
There is no in-person boutique this year. We have moved everything online, and we're using an organization called Handbid that does a silent auction and also has a platform for just purchasing. And so that's all set up. It opened this morning, just a few minutes ago, and ready to roll.
Okay, and the auction then will run through when?
It's actually going to run through Saturday till 8 p.m. And so it's 5 days. And there's so many good items out there for auction this year. Just amazing outpouring from the community to support domestic violence survivors.
Rather than using kind of the auction platform, I mean, is there also like a buy it now where people don't have to stay on top of the bidding?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's actually two different platforms there. One is the auction, and one is a sale. And so some items you can purchase, the bling traditional items like jewelry and purses, you can purchase right off of the for sale platform. Many of those items are gently used, but a few of them are new. And then the auction platform has tons of great items, which has a buy now key. But we've got trip to Sun Valley with 2-night stay in a deluxe Limelight hotel. 2 guests, you get 4 1-day lift tickets and a $100 gift card to the Pioneer Saloon and Restaurant. Foursomes at golf clubs like Park Meadows, Promontory, Soldier Hollow, Touhey. We've got an amazing painting by Bill Cranstover. And so many other things.
Yes. Julie, why did the board want to go through with this? I mean, it was a lot of work, I'm sure, to put this on an online platform.
It was a lot of work, but the need is great. As you know, Leslie, it's been a really especially devastating year for victims of domestic violence. Domestic violence is surging globally and here at home. Calls to the Peace House helplines have increased 50% from this time last year. And our emergency shelter at the community campus in Park City has been at or near capacity throughout the pandemic. So all of the proceeds from this online auction and sale go to support our operational costs, which have been significantly increased. Stays at the shelter, the average length of stay has doubled in the last year. And so we have increased costs to provide food and cleaning supplies and to implement sanitation protocols to protect the health of our staff and clients. So this is an important fundraiser, and it's a great opportunity for people who have really come to know and love Bling Fling to do their holiday shopping from the comfort and safety of their own home and support Peace House at the same time.
Usually you have charged an entrance fee. I mean, for those getting in earlier, it was a little bit more. So this is actually open to everybody, and there is no cost to participate?
That's correct. There's no charge to participate, and everyone can jump right in there.
Okay. And again, it's underway at what, peacehouse.org?
Yeah, you can either download the HandBid app on your phone and put Bling It On in for the event. The auction will come up, or if it's easier, you can go to our website and go to the Bling It On events page, and it will have the link that you can get to on either your computer or your phone.
Okay. And then in terms of the need, Julie, you've did pretty well with Live PC, Give CC. Of course, you've got this, and you did really well with the capital campaign. So, are you financially? You're doing okay.
We're doing okay, but as I said, the demand has been unprecedented. Victims of domestic violence are facing more danger than ever. In addition to the additional expenses that I mentioned earlier, we're providing quite a few more hours in support of legal advocacy and case management. So while we have had some successful events, our costs are increasing dramatically. So I should also mention that if you for some reason get out to our auction and sale website and you're not able to find something that tickles your fancy, you can also just go online and make a donation that'll go directly to support the operating expenses for Peace House.
Okay. Anything else you guys wanted to mention?
No. If I could interject one more thing, we do have some fabulous art items that local artists have donated, people like Susan Swartz and Brett Webster. Many of those items are on display right now at the Poison Creek Furniture and Design store at 1255 Iron Horse Drive. So if you'd like to see some of the art that's available at the auction, you can go down there and take a look. And they're practicing social distancing and requiring masks in order to go do that.
Okay. Hey, Sally and Julie, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, taking a look at some local news, portions of both the Jordanelle Parkway and Richardson Flat Road are scheduled to be designated under Wasatch County's jurisdiction. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on that.
The designation is made by the Wasatch County manager, Mike Davis, who says it won't impact the MIDA project at Mayflower or the town of Hideout.
This shouldn't impact really anybody other than ourselves to the degree that these have been our county roads. They're dedicated to the county. When Hideout did their recent annexation, they used these sections of road to connect to the properties in Summit County that they annexed. The declaration will not remove these roads from Hideout. They'll still be part of Hideout, but it keeps the jurisdiction of the roads to Wasatch County.
Davis is working with UDOT Region 2 to put in a stoplight at the intersection of Jordanelle Parkway and Richardson Flat Road,
which will involve issues in the right-of-way of this section of road for turn lanes and position of signal infrastructure and so forth. And so we want to maintain all of this going forward. It doesn't restrict anybody from driving on the roads or anything like that, but we would maintain the easement in the right-of-way. So we would plow it, we would fix it, but it's still public access, it's still in Hideout, so it shouldn't change any of that.
Wasatch County Council member Steve Farrell asked for clarification on how maintenance will be managed since the road is in the Hideout town boundaries.
Hideout is going to have to maintain that road then from that county ride to the end of their annexation.
They will, and throughout their development. Yep.
Okay.
But it is still within the Hideout town boundary, even though we're maintaining it in the right of way. It's still within the boundary, so it still maintains the connection.
In no way the county can be required to maintain it, even though it's in Hideout, into Summit County.
No, and the limit of my declaration is to the county line.
Okay, good.
Davis says the surveyors clarified the right of way, which does not include any of the lands around Stock Building Supply.
Has anybody talked to you from Hideout?
Not recently. We did talk to the surveyor for the attorney that was preparing the annexation at the time, told them of our intent to do that, and they said, well, we would probably give it back to you anyway. This is, the state code allows us to do this, so they were very aware of it before they ever did the annexation, that the county would want that back. Let's go through the legal description that was used for the annexation, and that verified that the only portion that's included in their annexation are these two roads.
State code allows county managers to declare jurisdiction over roads within annexations if they are deemed critical to the county's needs. Davis says it should be complete by the spring of 2021. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Utah's Governor Gary Herbert announced new COVID-19 health orders on Sunday that went into effect Monday afternoon. While his new orders mandate masks and restrict social gatherings, KPCW's Jessica Lowell reports that his overarching message is individual responsibility.
During the press conference on Monday, Governor Gary Herbert clarified some of the new restrictions in place to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. He announced new health orders Sunday night, which mandate masks until further notice and restrict social gatherings to same households until November 23rd. While there are penalties for people who don't follow the rules, Herbert says many of the restrictions fall on individual compliance.
Again, I know what the reality is. It's going to be hard to identify and it's going to be hard to enforce, but it is enforceable. This is less about government mandates and us telling you what to do. It's more about taking personal responsibility.
He says they are restricting gatherings for 2 weeks because that's the incubation period. State epidemiologist Angela Dunn says that should be enough time to see case numbers decrease.
Again, it's going to really depend on all of us adhering to these principles. And we'll watch the data to see what is needed past the 2 weeks.
When Herbert was asked if the order could be extended past 2 weeks, he said he wanted to remain positive.
Well, let's not think negatively. Let's think positively that people, in fact, will gather together and unite in a common effort for the common good.
Under the new restrictions, businesses can remain open and places of worship can decide if they want to mandate masks.
It's certainly an attempt to find the right balance point of making sure we do what we need to do to protect people's health and yet allow people to still have their First Amendment rights of worship. Not telling churches how to conduct themselves. I think that's inappropriate. Making sure that businesses can continue to function. We're still open for business with appropriate protocols in place.
For the next 2 weeks, all extracurricular activities are canceled except high school playoff and championship games and intercollegiate sports. Herbert clarified that the audience for those games is restricted. He says players can bring two fans to the stadium and they must wear masks and maintain social distance. He also clarified that athletic events hosted by private companies like dance teams and karate classes are allowed to continue through the two-week period as long as they adhere to mask mandates and social distancing. Herbert also updated the state of emergency on Monday to include that bars can be open only until 10 p.m. And he says restaurants do not have to ask patrons if they're from the same household.
That burden is placed upon the individuals themselves that come into the restaurant. And we've asked people, for the next 2 weeks, to sacrifice a bit and make sure that they are associations with members of their own household and not outside that arena.
The last part of the new health orders expand testing. College students will be tested once a week, starting no later than January 1st. These will be rapid tests, which do not require medical personnel to administer the test.
We could get up to 20, 30,000 a day. And we have the ability with the federal help to do that. We are going to certainly make that attempt.
And Dunn addressed concerns about the increase in testing yielding more positive results.
So initially, when we roll out a lot of testing at once, we will likely find additional cases. But over the coming weeks and months, that will result in a decrease in spread and a decrease in cases, because individuals who have very mild symptoms or perhaps no symptoms at all will know their COVID status and they will be able to isolate appropriately, preventing spread from additional individuals.
She says increasing testing will decrease hospitalizations and deaths throughout the state. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.